Good evening, everyone, and welcome to anyone who's here for the first time. I think we have one new person tonight. Welcome. So this is our sixth and final installment of this series that I've been doing over the in recent weeks. We've been looking at the ways that we human beings perceive difference or separation from others, and the way that produces great suffering in both our personal lives and our collective social and political lives. And we've looked at how we can be guided on the path of the Bodhisattva when we encounter injustice in the world. Now, of course, the concept of justice is itself a human construct. And what we're talking about here is, I didn't really give this background at the beginning about the different kinds of justice. Because, of course, there's retributive justice, right? An eye for an eye, tooth for the tooth, punishment for crimes. And there's restorative justice. We used to have restorative justice people next door, where relationship, when harm has been done in a relationship severed, where the relationship is restored and reparations made. But what we're talking about mostly here is distributive justice and evenness or equality when it comes to basic human needs: food, clothing, shelter, safety, education, health care, employment, clean air, water, and soil. And as we've seen, human beings have a strong tendency to discriminate against those perceived as other, as lesser, somehow less entitled to all those things I just listed. And those discriminations are based on gender, sexuality, class, race, religion, age, physical and mental ability. That's just the short list. But do these concepts of justice and injustice or rights even apply beyond the human realm? What about the interests of whales or plankton, red cedars, obscure orchids that haven't even been discovered yet, rainforest frogs, when they conflict with human needs? Human need or human greed? Mm-hmm. Now, it's not my intention tonight, it's beyond the scope of what I can attempt to lay out some philosophical framework for animal rights. People have been wrestling with those questions for some time already and continue to do so. But I do want to extend our discussion of difference and unity beyond our species for our last night. Because the worldview of our modern Western civilization is so profoundly human-centric, don't you think? We're ambivalent about animals. We might not be ambivalent about our precious cat or dog. Well, sometimes we're even a little ambivalent about them. But overall, there are animals we love, the pets that we make part of our families, the beautiful and awesome wild animals, and there are animals we hate, or at least many people do: mice, rats, snakes, mosquitoes, spiders, right? And then there are those we eat, depending on our culture and our values. There's a wonderful book about this called Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat: Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals, by Hal Herzog. He's an anthrozoologist. Did you know there was such a thing as an anthrozoologist? Studying the relationships between humans and animals. He gives examples of how wildly inconsistent and irrational humans are in the ways that we feel and act towards animals. There are human cultures that love dogs and those that loathe dogs and those that eat dogs. And those that use dogs for hunting and treasure them and use dogs for hunting and abuse them. He gives examples of all these. Dogs and cats are the main animals that many people in modern urban environments come into contact with. And yet the existence of urban pets is so domesticated, sometimes even to the point of surreality, it doesn't give us much feeling for wildness. Children growing up in a large city these days may have almost no direct contact with wild animals. Maybe pigeons, rats, crows, sparrows, flies, and if it's a city like Vancouver, some coyotes and raccoons. And skunks. The wild animals that they see on TV, children or adults, if you even watch nature documentaries, I don't know if children watch them anymore, but have you watched nature documentaries lately? They're all jazzed up with special effects. They look like computer games. Partly. Presumably to appeal to a habitually overstimulated younger audience. An indication of this impoverishment in our relationship with the other than human world is the changes in our language. I've been reading this British writer, Robert McFarlane. His book is called Landmarks, and it's about the vanishing vocabulary of the land. His inquiry was sparked originally when friends who lived in the Outer Hebrides Islands showed him what they called a peat glossary. Everybody know what peat is? Yeah, it's layers and layers of compressed vegetation that can be dry, cut deeply in the earth and dried and burned, like in Ireland. They used to use peat for fuel. If peat was compressed for much, much, much longer, it would probably turn into coal. So a peat glossary that these people had compiled with hundreds of Gaelic terms for the moorland on the Isle of Lewis in the Hebrides. Some words still in use, some fallen out of usage. So that sparked McFarlane to search out. He had, through this book, he's got glossaries for all different kinds of land-related words. But he says, and I'll quote him, "The same year I first saw the peat glossary, a new edition of the Oxford Junior Dictionary was published. A sharp-eyed reader noticed that there had been a culling of words concerning nature. Under pressure, Oxford University Press revealed a list of the entries it no longer felt to be relevant to modern-day childhood. The deletions included acorn, ash, beech, bluebell, buttercup, catkin, cowslip, dandelion, fern, hazel, heather, heron, ivy, kingfisher." How many people here know what a kingfisher is? Pretty good. It's a bird that catches fish. And you can see them on the Fraser River and lakes around here. Nectar, newt, otter, pasture, willow, all dropped from the dictionary. Okay, what was added? Block graph, blog, broadband, bullet point, celebrity, chat room, cut and paste, MP3 player, and voicemail. And yet, from the earliest stages of human evolution, it was our relationships with the natural world, and particularly with other animals, that shaped us. Paul Shepherd, this is also really been really interesting reading. He's a a professor of human ecology. And he wrote this book, The Others, How Animals Made Us Human. And he describes this process starting with perception and cognitive development and extending to every aspect of culture of how we were shaped by our relationships with the non-human world, and particularly animals. As we evolved from proto-human apes, our abilities to track sound and visual cues from moment to moment gave us the capacity for both memory and foresight, what he calls our attentional structure. And of course, our attentional structure is what we pay attention to in our practice, isn't it? And that attentional structure was developed and honed in the process of observing and interacting with animals through the dance of predator and prey. It's really interesting. But in the interest of time, I'm not going to give you the long quote that I thought I would. But it was through these relationships with others, with the animals and plants, upon which and our lives are completely dependent, right? That we develop language and symbolic thought. In the very old times, the elders of indigenous peoples tell us humans and animals could understand each other's language. You've probably heard those stories. Sometimes humans even intermarried. Have you heard the folk tales of a woman marrying a bear or a man marrying a crane in Japanese? In Japanese folklore, there's a story of a man marrying a crane. And so animals were not only themselves, but they came to represent parts of ourselves, qualities we wish to have. The strength of the bear, the courage of the lion, the cleverness of the raven, and of course the wiliness of coyote. We decorated our bodies with their feathers and skins. We made songs mimicking their voices and dances based on their movements. We learned to name and categorize them. He says that our ability to name and make categories came from our relationships with the plants and animals. We learned skills from them, how to weave, how to catch fish, what plants could heal us. The oral traditions of indigenous cultures around the world tell of these animals' gifts to us. You know, they come through in stories of the animals' gifts to us. Michael just told me over dinner that he's reading a history of tea, which goes back to the foothills of the Himalayas, the first wild tea bushes or trees. They grow quite large, larger than we think. And that animals chewed the leaves. And so humans began to chew the leaves. And from there, you know, it went to the incredible complex culture of tea in different countries. And we made prayers to them in praise, thanks, and invocation. They taught us about impermanence, transformation. Think of all the transformations in the animal world. Mutability of form, life and death. We made them our gods, and then in time we toppled them and made gods in human form. Sometimes we kept the image of the animal with the god riding or seated. On the animal. We can see this even in Buddhist iconography. The Bodhisattva Manjushri, Bodhisattva of Wisdom, is pictured seated on a lion, and Samantabhadra, Bodhisattva of Practice, seated on an elephant, and Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva of Compassion, pictured with a dragon swirled around her feet. But eventually we worshipped a single god who we claimed created us in his image and gave us dominion over the earth and all the other creatures. We are the crown of creation, and animals have no soul and cannot be saved by that view. They're here for us to use and abuse for our needs. And somewhere along the line, we lost the value of taking just what we need and no more and not wasting. Using with reverence and gratitude the gifts of the animals. And now our boundless greed threatens the well-being of the creatures and the earth systems on which our life is still utterly dependent, despite techno-fantasies of colonizing Mars or bioengineering meat so we don't have to deal with the smelly, messy, controversial business of raising animals to eat. You know they're trying to do that? Make biological meat, bypassing the animals. Long ago, I had a long, complex dream of going to Mars and encountering a civilization there completely enclosed. In giant, you couldn't even see, you could hardly see the top of the enclosure. It's like these giant greenhouse things. And I was given a tour around this big enclosure. And when I was told that they were unable to keep wild birds in this environment, I felt this huge sadness, this terrible sadness in my dream. Many Westerners look for a spiritual practice that supports environmental and ecological principles. And we've looked to indigenous traditions and also to Buddhism. And I believe that support is there, that those principles are there. And in a moment I'll say where we can find them. But first a caveat. I don't think that Buddhism has provided immunity to human greed. It hasn't kept Japan from plundering virgin rainforests in Indonesia. And it hasn't prevented Chinese cultures from driving African elephants and rhinos to the brink of extinction for their tusks and horns, ostensibly to shore up male virility. I remember when Michael and I visited Burma, gosh, 30 years ago. And we went to the ancient city of Bagan, which was the capital of the kingdom of Pagan, which at its height from the 11th to the 13th centuries united what is now called Myanmar. It lies on a wide, wide plain, and it's scattered with thousands of elegant ruins of Buddhist temples and stupas. But I remember being sobered to learn that entire wide plain had been deforested to fuel the kilns, to make the bricks, to build the temples. And the temples, of course, were patronized by the rulers, by the wealthy class, to glorify the empire. I remember reading something similar about Greece. Greece used to be heavily forested. I've never been there, but if you have, you know it's not now. Human destruction of the environment did not begin with the Industrial Revolution. It's just accelerated since then, particularly in the past century. So in early Buddhism, animals appear mostly in the Jataka tales. These are stories, they're like folk tales, really, of the Buddha's former lives as a bodhisattva appearing in various incarnations on his way to Buddhahood. And the tales often feature the Buddha to come as an animal, showing wisdom and compassion towards other animals or towards humans, sometimes sacrificing its own body, the animal's own body. So the animal realm is pictured in Buddhist, early Buddhist cosmology as one. You've seen the wheel of life with the six realms. At the bottom is the hell realm. And then next over here is the hungry ghost realm, and then on the other side, corresponding is the animal realm. Then comes the human realm, and the realm of the angry titans, and then up at the top is the heavenly beings. And these would be classically the realms that one would move through from one incarnation to the next, depending on what merit or demerit, karmic demerit or merit you had accrued in your previous life, you would move into a more favorable or less favorable realm. Now those realms can also describe the body-mind states that we can move through in the course of one lifetime, or a single day, or a single zazen period, you may have noticed, right? So these actually are powerful descriptions of these sort of archetypal descriptions of mind states. But animals are included. They're included in that picture of awakening beings. They're not excluded because they don't have souls, for example. In Tibetan Buddhism, there is a teaching that every being may once have been our mother, so we owe them kindness. In a very real sense, the stuff that we are made of has passed through bodies of countless beings, right? And the lives of countless beings have given us birth, right? This reality is given symbolic representation in the Mahayana Buddhist Buddhism of China. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, there's an image of Indra's net. I'm sure most of you have heard of it. Indra was the king of gods, and his net is as vast as the universe, with a jewel at each node or intersection in the net. And each jewel reflects every other jewel. It's kind of a holographic image, I think. So that anything that happens to one jewel reverberates and affects every other part of the net. It's a beautiful image of our limitless interconnection with all beings. And it's a radically inclusive image of boundless interconnection throughout space and time. And this being our true nature, the true nature of existence. Hence, the classic Zen koan, I'm sure all heard, does a dog have Buddha nature? On one occasion, the great Zen master Zhao Zhou answers no, on another occasion he answers yes. But he makes it clear, it's not a matter of affirming or denying, but of going beyond duality, of embracing the simultaneous realities that we've been talking about throughout this series of the relative, the particular, and the absolute unity, infinite connection. Those two simultaneous interpenetrating realities. Which allows plants and animals their place in the cosmos as living beings in dynamic interrelationship with us and with each other. This past Sunday, some of you were here, we commemorated the Buddha's death, which is also called his final enlightenment, with a ceremony. And we put this picture up, which is traditionally displayed at that time in Japan. And this one is particularly dear to us because it was hung in a very old Rinzai Zen temple very near where we lived. So we'd go and see this every year. And it's huge. It's like
10 meters by 7 meters.
10 meters by 7 meters.
Wow.
And there's this huge big hall just built to contain the scroll. It's rolled up except once a year when it's displayed. So the scroll is like this, rolled up. And if you can see, here are all the disciples and the bodhisattvas and the heavenly beings mourning the death of the Buddha. And here are all the animals as well, included. And This is from, I think, 17th century. And there's another one that I will put on the kitchen table for you to look at afterwards. This is a very beautiful one. These are called Neihanzu. Neihan is that Japanese for Pari Nirvana, which means final enlightenment. Neihan paintings. And this one has not only all the animals that you see there, but sea creatures. There's whales and fishes, and there's an octopus, and there's insects, and there's even a cat. This is the only one that has a cat. Cats were banned from these pictures because, well, you know how bad they are. You know? they play with the mice, and when one of the stories, there's more than one story about why cats are banned from these pictures, but is that cats kill for pleasure, not just for need, and they kill more than they need. I'm sure cats are not the only ones who do that, but this artist said, no discrimination, I'm putting in a cat. So, I really like this one too. And this artist Ito Jakuchu made a Neihanzu all of vegetables. It's called the Vegetable Neihan. And he put a big daikon radish in the place of the Buddha and all the vegetables surrounding. And he put kunj stalks instead of the sal trees. And this is no mere parody. This is his, for one thing, loving tribute to his origins. He came from a merchant family, a greengrocer in Kyoto. So his family were greengrocers, sold vegetables. And he became a highly renowned artist. Very famous artist. And a Zen practitioner. He was a very serious Zen practitioner. So not only was this his personal tribute to his family and his personal feeling for vegetables, it also reflects, it's a direct reference to a chapter in the Lotus Sutra called The Parable of the Medicinal Herbs, in which the Buddha uses this analogy. I'll read you just this short line. The rain falling from one blanket of clouds accords with each particular species and nature, causing it to sprout and mature, to blossom and bear fruit. Though all these plants and trees grow in the same earth and are moistened by the same rain, each has its differences and particulars. So this is called the parable. Of the medicinal herbs, and it's the source of the phrase Dharma Rain. You've heard there's a Zen group in Oregon called Dharma Rain. So the nourishing rain of the Dharma is available to all equally, and each being expresses Buddha nature in its own particular way. In Japanese culture, a kind of sentience different from our own is attributed to the plant realm. I found this beautiful passage from an anonymous 16th century text depicting a competition for excellence between the plum tree and the bamboo. And I really love this. I couldn't copy it. I don't usually bring a laptop to Dharma Talks, but... Okay, I might have to... Okay, here it is. Plants and trees have no human feelings. Flowers do not speak. But though unresponsive to human feelings like trees and rocks, their original nature, like that of human beings, is the Buddha mind. In winter, fields and hills wither away under the frost. The treetops become sparse. It seems that plants and trees, as if entering nirvana, hide underneath the fallen white snow. The Dharma of this world, birth, aging, sickness, and death, is manifest. Plants and trees are not inferior to humans. Plants and trees, while they have heart, do not speak. Though devoid of speech, they respond to seasons and are subject to the change of time, so they have their own feelings. And the feelings, in parentheses, the word is kokoro, which is heart-mind. So plants have their own kokoro. One must not, even by mistake, cut down plants and trees without reason. And then it refers to this vegetable nehan picture. Dogen, who founded our school of Zen in Japan, when he comments on the koan of does a dog have Buddha nature, insists that it's not a matter of having Buddha nature, but of being Buddha nature. He uses the verb being Buddha nature. Repeatedly in his teachings, he challenges the distinction between sentient and insentient beings. He asks us to see and listen deeply to the Dharma of beings different from us, whether they are human beings who seem different and strange to us, outside our zone of comfort, or animals, plants, forests, mountains, waters. Our practice is to attend to our own conditioned responses, positive, negative, neutral, and open to the being that is right before us now. Because they are us, and if we close our hearts and minds to them, we close off part of ourselves. Paul Shepherd, the human ecologist, puts it this way: the animals and perhaps the plants within us are like the beings of a larger and older reality. They exist within us in much the same sense that our parents and our ancestors are in us, not as ghosts, but as shared form, a continuum of which we are only the present expression. I like that.
Sorry, who said that?
That was Paul Shepherd, who wrote The Others, How Animals Make Us Human. So maybe we can create or recreate an ethic of wisdom and care that includes, as First Nations people say, all my relations. Based on this deep understanding. Robert McFarland, the guy with the glossaries, uses a phrase that I hadn't heard before, species shame, to refer to the terrible awareness of what we humans have done to other species. It's a heartrending feeling. And we don't like to feel that way. Shame is one of the most unpleasant feelings, isn't it? We don't like feeling that. I think it's one strong reason we avoid taking responsibility for our collective behavior. How many of you have heard people say things like, "Don't blame me, I wasn't alive when all that happened," right? "I wasn't alive when the buffalo were slaughtered or when the Indians were massacred. I never kept slaves. I'm not prejudiced. I'm a vegan. Don't blame me." Keep all that at arm's length. Behind that pushing away of others' pain is a need to protect the self from that pain of shame or guilt. We don't want to feel like bad people, right? Nobody wants to feel like a bad person. So we really need to use the verse of repentance. You know that we chant once a month when we do the precept, Bodhisattva precept ceremony? But not with a sense just of personal purification, but with a deep understanding of our shared karma as human beings, our shared responsibility We don't have to feel guilty about the past, but we do take responsibility for now, for what to do now, how to respond now. So we can say all our ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, we now fully avow. There's that collective aspect that has been neglected. And then we can establish an ethic of right speech and action based on both wisdom and compassion, and on the bodhisattva vow to care for all beings. An ethic of care trumps one of fear and hatred. And that, as you probably know, is a deliberate pun. And to care about beings in the many ways that they are different from us, the beings outside our tribe, we must pay attention to them, learn from them, receive the Dharma of their being. So my hope in bringing these questions and conversations into the Zendo in these past weeks has not been to be prescriptive, not to say you should go out and do, you know, this specific kind of work or activism in the world, but that we deeply investigate, you know, our own conditioning and realize that our well-being on this planet is mutually dependent with that of beings who are different from us and who are also intrinsically one with us. So, there's so much that I want to share with you from my readings and investigations over this time that I always talk a little too long. What we've done each week is make circles and talk about sort of our own personal experiences with different kinds of otherness. And in this case, what I would ask you to do, and I'm not going to this time because I have another idea, is ask you to just think back in your early experiences of encountering other than human beings, right? Particularly animals. And what shaped those, you know? Was there fear? Was there attraction? What in your environment shaped what that experience was for you? So I'd encourage you to take, you know, do that reflection in the way that we have in the other areas this week. But what I had wanted you to do, okay, I think there's time, is write a little, just three short praise poem. Pick a being, another species, and just write a sentence or three little lines like a little haiku in praise. Many, many indigenous traditions have songs and prayers and of praise and gratitude to the animal world. Okay, so just pick one and briefly write something down. Don't have to think of it as a poem, but even just a sentence.